Hey, I'm Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
This is our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. But the other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only three beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars.
And don't forget to leave a comment.
Your support will help us expand our audience and create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, I want to mention our guidebook / workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your musical life and career on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from My Music Masterclass. And if you want to learn more, just go to mymusicmasterclass.com, hit subscribe in the header menu, and you'll be good to go. All right. So we're here today. This is our second time doing video with our podcast, and we're super excited to have Steve Jenkins with us, who's a New Yorker I've known for a bit because, you know, he's on the website. He's also an amazing bassist. He's a great solo artist. He's got some very cool records. He's played as a sideman with, Screaming Headless Torsos with Fizinski. Vernon Reed was a great one. And, you know, I know you did stuff at Victor Wooten's camp and all these other things. And he's a monster player, but he's also a super cool guy and a really smart dude with some really cool perspectives. And I thought it'd be great to hear what he has to say. What do you think? Anyway, it's great to have you, man.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for the nice intro.
Oh, man. That's
yeah,
the least
the hell,
I could do.
I never get an intro. God.
No, you don't get an intro. But, man, so what have you been doing recently? Let's start from the beginning of this pandemic. I know that you're in LA now, so Steve, I knew mm-hmm. Steve when he was in New York, and he was a Berkeley cat originally, and then came down, was working a bunch, decided to move to LA, much like I did, except that I moved back to the East Coast when you moved to LA. So how was that transition for you? And like, I guess start from that, because that's kind of an interesting topic in itself, you know, moving coast to coast, right?
Well, so I moved to LA in early 2017.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Nice.
And I'd been in New York for 13 years, and I kind of felt like I was at the end of the line. Not that things were going badly, but I just didn't really know what else I wanted to do there, you know? And I don't, it's interesting now as I'm talking about this, I have a different view of what maybe I was experiencing, but I think I knew I really wasn't interested in doing like Broadway at all.
Yeah. Right.
Like I tried it and it just wasn't for me. And I think I'm not attacking that lane that people choose, but I just know that like,
but you
it's kind of
like a pit musician kind of thing.
Yeah, like being a,
yeah,
being
I mean
a,
it's kind of a big thing in New York, I mean, especially for stability at this point, you know.
Yeah,
well, not
yeah.
Now COVID fucked everything up, but yeah.
Yeah, like I'm not slighting it because I know it's like a whole other thing, but my take on that was, well, if I have to fight my way into a different scene, I'll just go to a different city because maybe it's just time to do that. And there was a good convergence of the roommate I had. He was getting serious with his girlfriend, and so she was going to move in, which meant I had to move out anyway. And I just, when I moved into that place, I kind of knew this is my last little bit of time in New York, and then I'm going to leave. You know, so I lived in that place for like a year and maybe 8 months, and I'd already kind of prepared myself in the beginning of 2016 that like I probably won't last the year in New York. I'm going to move and check it out. So, you know, I did some recon. Like I went to LA in September of 2016, basically subletted a friend's place who was going to be gone. And so I got to check it out.
Wasn't that like due to NAMM?
I was going to say that's like the perfect time.
I thought you went there. Didn't you stay at Travis's place?
I did for a little bit. Like was like when I was looking for a place.
It's a good scouting time for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So I ended up, Travis actually helped me find a place. So when I got out here, I was sharing a house with a friend of ours who he was going through some personal stuff. Like I think he and his wife were splitting and he needed someone to help, you know, offset some of the cost of living in a house. So I landed there for a few months and it was cool. And then I finally got my own place and I've been there ever since. So I don't really know what's happening in LA, man. Like I've been here for that long and I don't know if I'm staying. COVID hit at a weird time because I feel like from the time I landed here to now, I haven't really done anything that's justified me coming out here. Like I've done some touring with different people, which I don't want to sound dark, but like I'm 45. So I've like done some shit and like I've had experiences. So it's like, it's different. My experience on, or my take on it now is different than if I was like 25, but it's just like, especially the last experience I had touring, that was one of those come to Jesus moments for me, man, where it's like, I don't think I want to do this anymore unless I can do it on a level that's like better than this. And I've done stuff like that before. Like, I mean, this is a situation where, and I don't think it matters if I name the person, but I'm not going to.
I know who it is, and that's all that matters.
Yeah.
I'll write it in the description of the YouTube.
But that shit matters, like the level of like what you're doing out there, because it becomes your living situation. I mean, that's a huge deal.
I know what you mean, Steve. I mean, and the thing is that like the artist that will remain unnamed, like Voldemort is you know, he's cool. He's a really good guitarist and he had his time, and it's like that level of like touring, which
right.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's probably a fun gig and all that stuff.
Yeah. It just, you know, the business side of it wasn't tight and it imploded a couple weeks after we started. I had to chase my money down, which was not cool. And I would say from that standpoint, 2019 was a worse year for me musically than 2020.
Right.
Even though 2020 was awful, like I was entering 2020 kind of in reset mode. Like I was just kind of stoked to play. And, you know, like I was so pissed from that tour that like it took me a few months to kind of figure it out, you know? And what I realized is that like that thing that I was talking about in the beginning of this answer, like where something made me want to leave New York. I think I've hit that point where I'm trying to pick and choose what parts of this I still want to do and the parts that like mean the most to me. And I think it's still possible to do that, but I think this idea of like trying to sort of like bow to this invisible hand that's gonna keep you doing stuff, like I don't buy that anymore, man. I think you can make your own happiness in this, and I think there's things that just suck and that's part of the deal, and you know, we all have our gripes, but I think I got to the place where it's like, okay, there isn't really a be-all end-all situation out here. There's a great lifestyle. There's great musicians. So I'm not upset that I moved, but I feel like some of the things I discovered had more to do with me than my location. And I wasn't expecting that. So
maybe just like a timing kind of thing. Just fucking.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's actually kind of like, that's like a soul searching kind of thing that, you know, it was happenstance. And it's true though, because what you said is a lot of what I experienced. So I moved to Los Angeles when, I don't know, I mean, what is it, 2008 around? And I was there for about 7 years. And my goal originally was to get more licensing work and writing for television work, because I was starting to do that in New York and getting gigs, but obviously there's more of that. So as a bass player, I knew I could always work because it's like what I did, how I started. And, you know, it's easier to pick up a gig than to, you know, write something quickly. Like I could always pick up a gig and make money to a certain degree. And anyway, I found that it was a different package, and there were some things that are better, right? I mean, like quality of life. Since I grew up in New York, I mean, it was nice that it didn't snow. You know what I mean? It was nice that every place has got like a dishwasher in it. It's not falling apart. You know what I mean? You have like a balcony, like, and things are cheaper on the peripheral. But when you look inside, you have to get a car and insurance and all the stuff that you wouldn't have in the city. So it evens out. But
it does, yeah.
But yeah, you know, there's a different side to the industry I found, and I don't know if you found this as well, like in terms of the scene. But for me, I've told this story many times. Like, I did this pop audition, and they had the bass in the monitors, like playing as I was playing the audition. Like, they really didn't give a shit what I sounded like, you know. And it was for like a Sony artist, you know. And I'm like, did I wear the right hat, or is the guy with the blue mohawk gonna get it, you know?
Right.
So that's kind of like, you know, it is a part of the industry, and if you can't accept that and you're salty about it, then you should like not be doing it, you know. I mean, because that, if for instance, you know, and Ruslan Sirota said it very elegantly, like when I talked to him about people being pissed about The Weeknd's band like having to pay for their own plane tickets or something like that for the Super Bowl, I think it was. And he said, well, you know, I mean, the problem is that there's a lot of people that can do that gig, you know what I mean? And that's what it is. It's not right, it's shitty, but yeah. It's like when you're in a position like that,
hey,
you know, shit comes. Happens. And I, from what I know of you, you know, you're a smart cat. Do you still enjoy probably writing and doing your own thing and all that? So are you going to put more eggs in that basket?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I don't really think I was ever really cut out for that other thing. But I don't begrudge people who are into that stuff, because I think there's like really good players that find themselves in that world who do a lot of things,
totally.
You know, and I don't have a problem with, like, I personally don't have a problem with like the entertainment part of the business. You know, I think it's important to remember that, like, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I actually kind of respect people that work in that field or that section of the field who kind of can do a few different things. Like, it's interesting to hear their take on it, but I think at the end of the day, I think that it's just a lane that people decide they're either into or not, you know. But I don't think I think the one thing that musicians should understand is like, nobody's really winning more by being in that lane. Not really. Like, not, because to me, like, I think if someone really wants to be in that world and they want to be an MD or they want to tour with pop artists and stuff, or then, you know, like, if that's what makes them happy, that's probably what's gonna, you know, be the thing that they strive for. But I don't know, man. I think there's a lot of different ways people can find their bliss if they're doing it professionally. I think what I've realized is like, a lot of it's gonna come from me carving out my own thing and finding people that either find that of value and that's how I get employed, versus, you know, as a side musician. But I don't know, man. I don't know if it's always such a black and white thing, because I think if the right thing came along, I would never rule myself out of doing anything like that. But, you know, it's like,
right.
I just think ultimately there's myths about all of that stuff. And if people knew what some of those cats actually made that are not on the upper end of those things, they would be like, really? Like, you know, because I can make more money playing a wedding gig
when wedding gigs are teaching.
Yeah. Yeah,
if you have a good plus, private, like, lesson set up, like, yeah, you're good to go.
Yeah. So
plus, you know the tunes are ready for the wedding gig most of the times, you know.
Right. I think it's about time, and I think it's more about the overarching thing. I mean, I think for me, my goals now are just, I want to get paid to be me. And
yeah,
if that means I got to teach or make my own thing, or, you know, at this point I'm kind of embraced the idea of content creation, and I haven't completely done the 180 with that yet, but I'm close to it, you know, because I tested the waters. I did like a podcast last year, which is, I'm going to revisit, but it was mostly just about the initial, what are people going to do while we're in this pandemic, you know?
Yeah,
right. But that's a tough angle to sustain, because things are morphing and,
right,
you know.
Plus, like, the podcast would still be going on with the same fucking question, because we're still in this thing. Like,
yeah. I mean,
we're slowly coming out of it. I remember we ordered like a handful of masks because we're like, oh, you know, we'll make some My Music Master masks, you know, whatever. And of course, you know, we sold out recently, or I don't know, a few months ago. And I'm like, do I get more? I mean, I didn't really expect to, you know, like this shit to last this long.
Yeah, just get like laminated vaccination card things.
Yeah, just sell them. Know. Yep.
But it just says like your instrument on it or something like that. Yeah. So some niche. Yeah.
They really just like after all that stuff, like today, I got my card and they were just like, that's all there is. They're like, don't lose it. She's like, we can't even backtrack it and like find it until like years from now. So don't lose it. Like if
I scanned it into my phone.
Oh, that's nice. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's like one of the coolest features with like I scanned it into my phone and I locked it in the notes. Yep. So basically you have to use face recognition to get to it.
There you go. Perfect.
But yeah, I don't know. I think it's okay to try to diversify a little bit, but I think one interesting thing that I've noticed is almost counter to what a lot of the advice was maybe 15 years ago. It's like, I think the idea of being a specialist now is probably the smartest thing people can do, even if it's not, you know, even if you might shoot yourself in the foot as like a side musician, because people aren't going to completely understand what your capabilities are, like just if you do that. But I think to a certain extent, like that's kind of the thing people are doing now, right? You know, like in a weird way.
I mean, I think that you're onto something, especially now. I had to write this article about cutting through the crowd, you know, and a big piece of that is, you know, whatever, search engine, like SEO, right? Because you do web stuff. So, I mean, but it's more about SEO. It's like a guitarist or a bass player. Like it starts in your hands, right? So before that, it starts on screen, like your talent. And it's not just how good you are, but like how you come across, how you show yourself. And we're all kind of trying to carve this niche. And if you don't, I don't know, if you don't have something special or different, like it's not really gonna jive anymore. Like I don't think you can be a jack of all trades, like with all the noise, you know what I mean? Like all the noise from everything. Do you agree? Like you should almost be the best at this or just have a really cool thing. And then you get your numbers up and then people are interested. And what does that equate to? I mean, it's tricky. You know, I've talked to a lot of different people about what Instagram, Mike Moreno actually had a really good algorithm almost. He said that he had a percentage of people that follow him on social media and the percentage of those people who will act on something that he's selling, like a live stream or whatever. And it was low, you know? I mean, it was like, whatever. What was it, like 20% or something like that? Or I don't remember.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's about, finding what you can do to shine and also what makes you happy. I mean, isn't that the ultimate goal, you know? I mean, because if it's not, you're just going to be depressed.
Well, that's what I was going to say about like city life too. You talk about New York. I think if once you make a move to a big city, the only job the city has is to fucking keep you inspired, because you're sacrificing fucking so many things to live there. It's expensive. It's annoying. It's batshit crazy, you know? So like if that inspiration stops, because like I've been in LA now since 2009 and it's like, if I didn't wake up and feel some sort of fuck yeah, I can like kind of do whatever I want. I can like figure shit out and make a business, whatever. Like if I didn't have that feeling anymore, I'd just be like, I got to get the hell out of here because it's not worth it. You know? So maybe that was like the New York thing for you, you know?
Yeah.
But then you moved here and it kind of just was a bad time maybe.
Well, I really like LA. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. In spite of whatever, you know, I mean, I can't, I mean, I like the thing, like whatever my gripes were, about like, or just from the angle of saying, well, I haven't really found what I came out here to do. I can't say that like the things I did were bad, you know, like I did a tour with Josh Smith. That was cool. Nice. Did some other stuff. I mean, it was fun to do that. Do I feel like that was the right place for me to be? No, not at all, but it was fun. You know, and like, it's weird. Like I did like, I listened to this track I played bass on, like, I think it was like 2 years ago, like it was in 2019. It was like this guy Gussie Miller, who's Marcus's cousin, and it was like this smooth, kind of like this smooth jazz R&B song, and it was like that dude Herman Matthews on drums, and this really great guitar player named Tony Polizzi, who's, you know, like, then they do a lot of like smooth jazz stuff. Herman played with Tower of Power, and like I hadn't listened to that recording in a minute, and I was like, damn, I actually sound like I play this shit, man. You know, like,
It's like you forget about it totally. It was just like, oh shit, I did that.
It's like sometimes you have to completely forget about it in order to like appreciate what you actually did.
Yeah, it was fun though, man. I remember like we banged it out fast, and you know, so there's been like a lot of trying on things out here, but I think, I mean, I had the same realization in New York to a certain degree, where it's like, man, you know, I moved to New York with a record out. I had just put out my first record. It got press in like magazines and stuff, like Jazz Is and Bass Player, and you know, I was completely independent, so I didn't have a label trying to put me on the road. But I do think that like ultimately that could have been I have a regret of not doing more to plug my own thing, you know, just like the whole idea. Cause I think there's things about the East Coast that are inherently advantageous compared to LA, and there's, it works the other way also. Like, the one thing about the East Coast that's interesting is you can literally go to like five different cities in a really short amount of time, and they're pretty big markets.
Yeah, because you mean like going to Philly and Jersey and
Philly, New Jersey, like Boston,
Providence, New York.
Yeah, I mean, Providence, DC. Yeah.
I try to look at LA like that, like little independent cities. You know, whether you're in like Silver Lake or you know, but it's not the same shit.
It's not the
like,
same.
Like New England and the East Coast, it's nooks and crannies, man. Like California's just a fucking, just the whole coast.
But you know, but I lived in Silver Lake and you know for years, and people that were near you in Culver, they'd be like, "Oh man, no, that shit, that's just too far, man. I'm not coming over."
I know they don't drink coffee with Adam. You know, I'm like, I'm gonna go get coffee. Oh, in Silver, what the fuck?
Let me leave
with
it. People? Like, let's leave 2 hours early because we got to get on the 10, you know?
Yeah, I used to drive.
Where
from
would
like,
you go to coffee there? You know,
oh God, Intelligentsia. What was
the place that we went to?
Intelligentsia is the bomb.
We'd walk to, though. That one was dope. It was just like a
there
no-name
was the coffee,
little...
The coffee table, I don't think it's around anymore. And then there's that one in Atwater that was dope. That one was cool, too. Like, I forget the name
of
it.
They had, like, belts made from, like, leather that the guy found in, like, you know, 1280.
And then there was...
Like, it was just, like, the most random shop with, like...
It's some hipster shit.
You could buy, like, a $700,000 belt or get a cup of coffee. You know?
Wow.
It was, like, what Bernstein was talking about with the monocle shop.
The monocle store. Yeah, Pete Bernstein was saying that there was a monocle store in 7th. I didn't ever realize that. It's like, for the people that don't want to order their monocles online, you know, you have to get them in person at the monocle store.
Wow. But, he was like, those businesses are in trouble. He's like, no one's ever bought anything from those places ever. They're obviously just like rich owners. But like now even those places are in trouble for COVID, you know?
I mean, it could be a front. I mean, for all we know. I mean, it's kind of nuts.
Oh, God, Jesus. It's a whole other conversation. That's a different podcast.
But exactly. No, but I mean, I hear what you're saying. It's definitely a journey for everyone, and it kind of sounds like you found yours, because it's not about rejection, it's not about lack of talent, it's about finding like what you really want to do and figuring out how to do that and be happy. And you know, the sideman thing is something that a lot of people are capable of, like we talked about, like if you have a certain skill level you can do that, but there is a lot of game playing that has to happen in the pop world, especially in Los Angeles. I mean, in New York too. I mean, it's
very, just not a fun feeling.
No, I mean, you definitely while, work. You know? You definitely get the feeling that you're like really working for someone, as opposed to like being at all friendly. You know, in certain
this is your role.
Ways.
You don't go above or beyond it. You know, just
which is cool, and
it is good for a certain thing. Yeah.
No, I mean, it can be cool. I remember talking to Travis Carlton about that. Once at the Baked Potato, we were talking, and we were talking about like those auditions, and he was saying the same thing. Like he's just like, man, I'm just not cut out for it, you know. Like I've done a few when I was younger, and you know, this just whatever, it's not my thing. And he's obviously a beast, you know, I mean, so it doesn't matter. He does his thing. So, but you know, it's like not everyone's cut out to do pop auditions or any of that stuff. And at the same time, a lot of those pop guys, you know, or pop people, you know, they can do anything. I mean, a lot of them are amazing musicians and they choose to do that because they love it. So, I mean, whatever it makes you feel good, you know,
but
it's tricky, you know, but so like, what have you, I know that you, got into some of the cool nerdy shit that I do, you know, I mean, like some of the coding and all that. I find it relaxing to do random stuff like that. Is that kind of where you're at with it and just like learning new skills and kind of getting involved and also in maybe, you know, merging that with what you're doing musically and all that, or how you feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely like exploring stuff like that. I think for me, it's more the idea of being able to learn new things. And just being able to figure out ways to understand how things work. The latest thing I've been kind of messing around with is Blender, because
totally
it's kind of a fun, it's kind of cool. And
yeah,
like
I have
my
a 3D
friend,
printer. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I don't use Blender, but I mean, I know it because of that.
Yeah. I like stuff like that. That kind of is my approach to a lot of stuff with music. Like I just like messing with stuff and seeing what I can do with it. So yeah, I mean that tends to just sometimes when I want to like take a break from something, I think it's one of those things where I just like to prove to myself that if I start with something I don't know anything about, after a few hours I have a little bit of like fluency with it, you know, like I can right. kind of, you know, it hasn't turned into the kind of thing where you know, I'm not ready to like look for jobs with any of that stuff mm. necessarily, but like I think the idea of not wanting to feel shackled to the music business is has always been kind of important to me, because I think that's the weird part about doing this that they don't teach you about in schools, that I think only people maybe who have like parents or family members that are lifers would probably be able to teach, which is that like you're going to have ups and downs, and sometimes when you're in the valleys of it, you might want to like just take a break or cut back on what you're doing. So, you know, like, I mean, I've worked day gigs before while I was out in the world, you know, like where I had records being reviewed, or I played on records that were being reviewed in magazines
it's,
and was sort
it's
of
nice
known.
Sometimes, man. It's yeah. a nice feeling, especially because it's I like you get to hang with, you get to hang with non-musicians and like, they're super interested in what you do. They're like, holy shit, you do all that? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I do this shit. You know, it's like, it's good. It kind of keeps you in reality too. Musicians yeah. can get a little crazy if they're.
Yeah. And it's also just like a natural way to, it's a natural way to unwind from
yeah.
your, you know, constant bombardment of the business. And, you know, even, and I've said this a lot to different people, but essentially, if you're full time and you're gigging 7 nights a week or whatever the case is, and just on overdrive, like you're going to hit a wall no matter who you are, and mm-hmm. you're going to have to unwind. So some people want to just walk in the woods or surf. But a lot of times people don't do anything for themselves and they just end up kind of burning out.
Right.
So, I mean, what better activity than doing something that is not music and it's fun for you and relaxing, but also can lead to making money. I mean, that's a win-win.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I had that thing happen where, you know, I played with Fusinski's music for like 5 years. So that included Screaming Headless Torsos, only touring. And then he had a trio and I did a lot with that. Like we made a record and, you know, that was a thing that I felt really cool to be involved with, because creatively, I guess when that mattered to me more, there was some validation there. It's like I'm playing with one of my heroes, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But inevitably, all these types of things come to an end. And, you know, I'd never been in a situation that kind of had that arc. So when it ended, I think I was feeling a couple things, which is like I was bummed. But I didn't feel like it was the wrong place for it to be, because I feel like, well, you know, 5 years is a long time. But I think also, you know, that question they always ask musicians, like, or, you know, you guys have probably had this question thrown at you, like, what's your ultimate gig, you know? and like,
yeah.
I feel like I got a lot of that stuff out of my system, because I got to play with a lot of people I always wanted to play with or pick their brain, or, you know, so I got to see a lot of it. And so I don't have a real focused answer for that question, but I feel like, I guess I realized that as that was winding down, and I kind of felt directionless. It's like, well, I don't know what I want to do now. Like, I don't know, right, like what kind of thing I want to do to, like, you know, keep this going. Like, or it wasn't
to fill that hole or something, maybe.
Yeah. So I ended up, this was kind of unfortunately around the time of the financial crisis, which is weird because now I look back fondly on that time period in New York, like just kind of scraping by and like having to account for every swipe of the Metro card and just, you know, it was awful, but it also kind of something kind of romanticized when I look back on it. Like when I think about it, like, oh, that was kind of fun having to jump the turnstiles once every couple days.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were alone, it'd be different, but you have a crew in New York, like that's, everyone's kind of in that shit.
Yeah. Together.
You know what I mean? It's I think that's the part of that.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I got a day gig for a while walking dogs, and I did that part time, you know, like in that I made a decent amount of cash. And when gigs started coming back after like the financial crisis was averted, however ways that happened, I dialed that back, and then I ended up taking like a part time gig at the Apple store in Soho. And there's like two things that happened when I worked there that wouldn't have happened any way else, even though it's possible they could have. One of those things was I met John McLaughlin.
Yes.
And he heard some of my music because like he was having a hard time getting the I guess the point of sale software was having some problems with connecting to the internet, so he needed someone to vouch for who he was, and I was like, this is John McLaughlin, man, you know, like,
yeah.
So then I told him we had a bunch of mutual people in common and what I did, and he listened to some stuff and wrote me this really nice email. But the second of those things, and this might have happened close to the time we filmed those courses way back, man, this would have been like 20, maybe this is 2012 or 2013, I can't remember.
Yeah
But Dennis Chambers was hanging out in the store because it was a hot summer day. He was still playing with Santana. And so I just hung, I just went up to him.
That awesome Santana joke. Was it you that made that one on Santana's
Maybe.
Birthday? It was the A minor and D7 one. I wish Santana happy birthday.
Yeah.
I think about that probably once a week, dude. And I just laugh my ass off. It's the best thing ever.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sorry, yeah, man. I mean, that's true, though, right?
Yeah.
It's truly, it's funny because it's true, of course. Yeah.
Santana's awesome, though, man. I mean, but so Dennis was hanging there, and we have a bunch of mutual friends. And so I was able to kind of just start talking to him, but I ended up playing him some of like the record I was about to put out, and he loved it. And he, like, basically played it for a bunch of other people, and then he called me up on the phone, and he was like, I'm gonna try to let Mike Varney hear this because, you know, maybe you can get a deal out of it. And it never came to fruition, but just the fact that he was down to help someone out was like really cool of him. And so I haven't talked to him in a while, but we connected on Facebook, and he sent me a message, and, you know, there's a bunch of friends of mine that know him really well, like Dana Hawkins knows Dennis really well, and a couple other people. So I got to meet him just in a way that wasn't like at the NAMM show or like some kind of busy musician thing. It was just kind of a chill day in New York, you know, and it was hot, and he just was hanging out because it was really, really, like, it was one of those really hot, disgusting days in the city. And I think they were playing at Jones Beach or something. And, you know, like, I think interactions like that are good to have. And sometimes like that, and that was like when I was kind of almost done with that job. So it was like, you know what? I don't care, man. I'll just sit here and, like, you know, pretend to show them some Bluetooth speakers and we'll just talk about music.
It's like, watch how these things play my record.
Yeah. Exactly. but it was cool, man. So I don't know. I think the other thing to what Jake was saying, like, there were a lot of people that were working at Apple at that time that were really, really talented, that were doing other things. Like, there's actors and comedians.
I had a genius bass player once, and he'd come with, like, all his Apple stories. He'd be like, mostly it's just people that didn't clean out their phone and their fucking memory was shot, you know?
Oh, man. Just like porn, You know, just their cash
just
is
delete
full.
The, like, the 80 fucking gigs of your kid's photos. You know, like, it's just, then you have a new phone.
Right. There is a genius that I knew, and he swore there was this woman that would, like, leave stuff on her computer for him to see.
That's awesome.
And claim that there were problems, which is kind of messed up, but
it's possible.
Awesome.
Yeah. But that job was weird, man. Like, I met some famous people on that job. Like, one time, Philip Seymour Hoffman came in.
Oh, man. He's the best. Oh, he was the best.
He was cool. Gandolfini came in once.
Nice, man.
That was heavy. Like, he looked really. It was kind of scary seeing him, man. I'll be honest. Like, it's hard
after
to not
watching
see
The
him.
Sopranos. I mean, yeah, for sure.
Like, that's the one thing I think I definitely appreciate about that city versus this city. Like, no one really cares about famous people the way they do out here. Like, New York, it's like I remember. I almost felt like I was on a nod basis with John Turturro, because he used to take a Q train near where I lived, you know, because when I was living in Prospect Heights, I think he lived in Park Slope. And a couple times I'd nod, well, you know, I wouldn't say anything, but just, you know.
Yeah. Like, you're like, you know, I'm going to leave you alone, but we're acknowledging each other.
Yeah. Like, it wasn't like, dude, why did you take Transformers? You know, like, why? Yeah.
He had a lot of fun with that one, though. But you could tell he was having a blast.
I mean, when I was in Brooklyn, I used to see De Niro on the platform, and I'm like, I love that shit. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm like, man, De Niro is taking the fucking subway. You know what I mean? And of course, like, it reroutes and you have to get off of it, and it just sucks. You know what I mean? The subway is just, I mean, it's great, but it also just, it always fucks you, like, when you're coming back from a gig and it's like 3 o'clock. And it, like, stops at, like, Atlantic, and then you have to cross a street and take another train. They're like, there's track work. You have to
do it.
Just like, oh.
I mean, I think you learn the true value of $20 when
exactly.
you travel at night, because you're like, do I want to spend $20 to get home?
Yeah.
Or is it worth 2 hours of, like, snaking through this system that's being worked on?
And you also see with drummers, it's the funnier thing, because you start to see the evolution of the drummer that moved to New York from somewhere else. They start
they
with like a legit
every gig.
They start with like a legit kit. You know what I mean? Like a 24 kick and all this stuff. And then they're by the end, they're using like a converted floor tom. You know what I mean? Or like 16s, stuff like that.
They're stuff like, automatically sounds better when you don't have to carry it.
Exactly. You know, that's, it's like, what amp?
Oh, they got a Harkey bass amp and a. Oh, yeah, great. That'll work.
Yeah, it's a crate. You know what I mean? Oh, perfect. Yeah, crate. I love it. Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Although we had Julian Coryell on, and he was saying that he had this crate amp in the studio that sounded amazing. So
I'm sure it's possible, man. I'm sure, like, you know, everything, there's a way to make it work.
Yeah, exactly. As long as it has enough watts, it'll probably work. Have you been writing it all and kind of getting your production chops up and just kind of starting, or I mean, you already had production chops, but have you been kind of like compiling something during this lockdown?
Yeah, I actually put a single out in March. Nice. I've been like teaching myself guitar for like, I mean, I've been playing guitar forever, but like I actually been like shedding guitar with some intent of just having better handle on my ideas with guitar. Just because I'll work on stuff for composition's sake and want to be able to fully realize the ideas. But I actually, I made a track that I liked enough to put out as a single as like the, you know, I guess the more progressive rock metal thing, like Steve Jenkins and the Quacks with Flutter.
Totally.
I put that out a month ago. And, you know, that, I think that's the one thing I've really kind of got dialed in this time period is like, I was already doing a lot of remote sessions and I already had some things that I liked doing for my bass tracks, you know, just as far as like figuring out like, you know, what would I like want to use on it. I kind of made that move to Universal Audio. So I use some of those things now. I don't always use that on my bass. It just, but sometimes I like it.
They have good stuff. I mean, you know, I don't complain about them at all, especially for their all the UAD stuff sounds great.
I like it a lot. I also like using some of that stuff on like the different instruments. But as far as guitar goes, I got into using a few of the Neural DSP plugins, which I like a lot. I think I found some things that sound really good. So yeah, I got into mixing that stuff and then, you know, programming drums. That's always been something I've loved to do. I feel like that's been getting better. I've been like learning how to do different things with that, which is stuff that I just didn't explore when I got into it. But like there are things that kind of are just obvious places to go with it, like separating everything into its own channel. And then
that's if you want it to sound real, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So getting into that, but you know, I make tracks all the time and I write stuff all the time. I think some of it, it's more for instant gratification. Like, all right, I'm going to make a video and put it on Instagram. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with this, but I'll make it. And then some stuff that, that I think is better that goes in a different file. And that's kind of like the way I do it. But I try to make a practice of doing that at least 4 times a week, no matter what, even if it's not great.
Yeah, just filling up the cup, man.
Yeah. You know? And even if it doesn't exactly reveal itself to be like an amazing thing right away, sometimes it's something I'll come back to or revisit. And I just like being of the mindset that, you know, there's something to show for what I've sat down and you know, come up with.
I always kind of equate it to like, you know, online like yoga posts. It's like people, I understand why they do it.
Where are you going with this?
Well, because they'll like make themselves make sure they exercise that day and they'll usually post
it. Oh, I see.
And like that's how I do. But it's one of those things where like if it's not on Facebook, it didn't happen. But like with ideas and creativeness, if you have an idea and you just let it go, it didn't fucking happen. So like you just screwed yourself. It was just like you just had a pointless idea. So if you don't record it, like that's the actual true sense of that word. Like if you didn't record it and put it somewhere, it just didn't happen and then it's gone forever. So it's like I definitely, that's a big practice I think a lot of people should do. You know?
Yeah. And there's also a difference between like documenting something, because we can all document on our phones now pretty easily, and actually recording it, you know, to a rig where you actually have a decent preamp and you sequence at least a basic drum part or something. So you have the idea and you can flesh it out later. Like that's even more productive. And, you know, there's so many ways people can go with their music too. You know, like some people get into licensing like I did, or some people, you just want to make a solo record. And sometimes you make a solo record and ends up doing licensing work. Or, you know, you just end up getting internet famous, and that can also help. I mean, there's a lot of things that can happen, but, you know, the most important thing is just making something that you believe in and that you love, right? I mean, that's what I would think.
I think there's also a lot of power in making little, you know, even if it's something that's just small, that's like 30 seconds, but sounds good. I think there's definitely value in putting that stuff out there, because I do think that people have control over what people know of their work, you know? Like if you want people to hear a certain side of your playing, there is power. You know, one has in putting that out there. It's like, okay, if you want to hear what I sound like playing a P bass or playing a fretless or playing on this kind of thing, you can put that out there and people can hear it, you know, for themselves. You don't have to wait.
Yeah. They're going to listen to that before they listen to a 4-minute track anyway. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's
well, nowadays, it's
like the music supervisor thing. Like if 20 seconds in, they're just going to ditch, you know what I mean? So it's actually like
it's important.
More powerful tool than anything, especially in a loop based kind of world with like you have like lo-fi, you know, DJs and all that kind of stuff. Like it is hip. It's never not been hip, to be honest. So it's like,
dude, but also
I'll
like
you throw down on a P bass for 30 seconds. Hell yeah.
but regardless of what instrument it is, it's like I think, you know, your point, which is strong, is that you're pushing out what you want to be represented or you want to be seen as. And that's what the power we all have as musicians in this digital age. We can literally take something that we're not as known for and say, I want to be more known for this, and show people what you can do and just put it out there. And if you can get enough eyes on it or in enough ears, I mean, that's a very cool thing that we can do now that we didn't used to be able to do.
Yeah. I think that's probably something that has benefited me personally in ways, you know, I'm not totally aware of. Because I know that, like, I've gotten calls for things through social media that have been cool, you know, or it's helped my cause. Like, if someone can just look and see what's happening, like, okay, yeah, let's use that guy.
Right.
I don't really know how other things would have manifested. Like, I got, you know, like, Chris Chaney threw me a session at the beginning of the year. And, like, I know Chris a little bit. Like, we're cool. And I've never been the type of person that's like, yo, man, if you get something you don't feel like doing, like, call, you know, throw my number. Like, right. I've never really felt like that approach worked that well. But I definitely think, because I just feel like, you know, guys and girls that, like, are busy in a scene and they're getting constant calls. I think they know, like, if they know who the available musicians are that could do those types of things, like, I think they would find the right people to route that stuff to if they couldn't do it. And I don't think anybody expects that people are, like, not looking for work. So it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know. I've never been comfortable dotting that I, where it's like, yo, if you need someone, give me a call. But yeah. I don't know.
I think that's smart. But
yeah.
Well, you do, like, it, I mean, you do it digitally. You're just reminding them that you exist. It's like,
I mean,
Adam, you always talk about, like, when you're back in town, you used to have to call cats and be like, I'm back in fucking town. But with the internet now, it's just like, oh, Adam's back in town. There he is at, like, the coffee shop, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so, you're right, dude.
That's a good point.
And yeah, exactly. I mean, I say that a lot. It's kind of like, I remember my friends used to do those cruise ship gigs or something, you know, and then you just have to, like, show up at everyone's gig and be like, hey, I'm back, you know, but I mean, the truth is you don't have to say it. You're right. You know? And, I think that you were saying this, or was it someone else, about the Victor Wooten thing as well, right? Weren't you kind of taken into that camp kind of the same way, just by, you didn't ask to be part of it, right? Or was that
the way that works? So that wasn't his camp in Nashville. That was basically, there was a thing I was teaching at Berkeley for years called Basslines. And when Rich Appleman was still the chairman of the bass department, this was like a 3-day summer program. And it was essentially something for generally, like, prospective students and maybe like people that weren't sure if they wanted to pull the trigger on the 5-week program, but they got a little bit of a taste of how Berkeley worked. And I don't know, like, how great enrollment was, but it always seemed like pretty decent. And it was always like a good couple days. And then when Rich stepped down and it was Steve Bailey, I think, you know, Steve's kind of like, how can I put this? He's kind of like a politician. Like, he knows, he's smart. He's very smart. And he put Victor Wooten as, like, the face of it. Like,
yeah.
So it was kind of like the Victor Wooten bass weekend thing. I don't remember what it was called. Yeah. I haven't done one of those since 2017. But so that changed around me, but it was essentially mostly the same. But it was pretty cool, man. I mean, like, I got to say, Vic's a really great guy. Totally. Steve's cool. I like what Steve's been doing with Berkeley's bass department. You know, I think the thing that is really great about Steve is he knows a lot of people. So if there's an interest of a particular thing, he knows people and can bring those people in to speak. Whether it's, like, you know, Ron Carter or, like, Justin Chancellor from Tool. Like, I like that about what they're doing. I also think, and this is a deeper conversation probably, but I think if there was ever a time for music schools that have to fight to exist compared to what else is out there, it's probably now.
And they should have to, because they've
made
a good amount of money.
Especially for the price.
Yeah. Like, I just think, you know, at the end of the day, like, if someone told a kid, well, you could buy 4 Audis or you could go to music school and learn how to play jazz, like, I don't know what I would choose.
I'd pick the 16 Olympic rings, man. 4 Audis.
You're right. It is like 5. I mean, it could be more than 4 Audis, to be honest. I mean, it depends on what kind of Audi, you know? I mean, I think NYU 75
one RS7.
A year.
I know that's a very cynical take, but
No, I'm with you. You know,
I honestly, definitely.
Yeah.
Did you guys? So I know you went to Patterson.
Me, right? I went to Manhattan School of Music.
Manhattan, okay, and then.
But Jake, I only went for a year.
I went to my backyard, UMass Dartmouth.
Okay.
But we had a cool program. It was kind of surprising. We had, you know, like Jim Robitaille was a fucking Thelonious Monk Award winning guitar player. We had a cat from Germany that was like running our department. He did like all the stuff on Jeff Buckley's Grace arrangements. Like he was a heavy jazz guy. Great. But older cat from Germany. But like it was, we were lucky. We were like, damn, it's my backyard. It's a tiny little school. But it's all who you get and who you study with. And then if you actually do the work anyway. So it's like, really, you're paying for, like, what are you paying for? That's the question you got to ask, like, when you enroll.
I mean, I was paying for location, you know? I mean, it was nice. Exactly. I mean, I grew up in Jersey, and then, you know, I was right across the bridge, so it was easy for me. Or the tunnel, I guess. But, I mean, you know, I tell people that I was working as I was in school, and, you know, in New York, I was able to go in between, and it was just easier because I always had work. I didn't move from far away. Yeah. It's an easy drive. And I had a car.
And like MI out here, you're paying for the fact that you're literally working in all the major studios. Either you're just automatically working there as like a runner, or you're just in there like mixing. Like it's like crazy. So MI is like, I mean, whatever the hell's going on at the school, who cares? You're in fucking LA working in the working studios, you know? So that's what it's paying for at that. Berkeley, you're paying to be around crazy cats and hopefully bust your ass because it's competitive, you know?
It is. They're peers. That's what I feel like I got. Like the people I went to school with that I was like kind of in there with, I think that there was value in that, but.
Hell yeah.
But it's, you know, it's weird. It's hard to quantify what that is now. Cause I think, you know, it's different. Cause I really think, I don't know, you know, it's like I talked to Charlie Hunter about this on my podcast and he was saying like, he'd rather give his kid like, I think $60,000 and like point him in the direction of a mentor and be like, if you want to learn how to do this, go follow this person around and like, and I think like that to a certain extent is important, but you know, I also think we're at an interesting juncture now where a lot of the old system doesn't work the way it used to.
No.
Because you've got people who have careers that really haven't done anything other than be successful at YouTube. And I'm not saying that as a slight. I just mean like there isn't like a thing where it's like, okay, like I guess I heard, I think it might have been Wayne Krantz talking about this because he used to teach at Berkeley when I was still living in Boston.
Right.
And it's not like I audited his class, but my friend used to record the lectures where he would just talk about stuff. And as much as I love his music, and I really do, he's a really smart guy. And he kind of has this like dryness to him that I think guys like us kind of like because we're East Coasters. Like, but he was saying that like there's not really anything like a Frank Zappa gig or a Miles gig where you do those gigs and you got career after that.
Not anymore. Because
even like the most minimal person in Miles's history as a band leader could get a gig on one of these big jazz festivals.
Easily.
And so now it's like, I think a lot of musicians like maybe my age and a little bit younger, my first record is what got my foot in the door. I didn't, like, that is how I got to playing with Vernon Reed and Fusinski. It wasn't they heard me and called me. It was like I called them. Fuse saw value in what I did, so he started calling me for his stuff. And then he referred me to Vernon Reed, and the shit just went on from there. But, like, just even that was, like, a different paradigm. Because, you know, it's like if you're, you know, if, I think for me and maybe, like, a lot of people that aren't related to musicians and don't know how it works, it's like you read stuff like the Miles autobiography and you're like, wait, so I got to like ride in cabs with like people I admire while they get blown by hookers. Like what, you know what I mean? Like
that,
shit like that.
And for those who, who didn't read that book, that's true. That's what happened in the book.
Sorry, man. I don't know who the target audience for this.
No, this is the target audience. A lot of like hookers and blowjobs. And you know, this is what we're looking for.
Right. But you know what I'm saying? Like it's, there's not really a, I think it's one of the things where there's not really any rules anymore, but a lot of the things that quantify someone's like worth, quote unquote, it's like, well, they play with that guy, so they must be good. Well,
you mean just like, I mean, the gatekeeper position is gone. You know what I mean?
Right.
It isn't. I mean, there's no like, it used to be, you're like, you're right. It was Miles. It was Zappa. He was right. He was a huge one. I mean, Zawinul to a certain degree, or John McLaughlin.
I'm trying to think of other ways people got
gigs,
got known. You know, I think that that had to have been the way a lot of stuff works, you know, or, you know, if someone's going to bring someone on the road, and kind of put them on that way. Like, I don't know if that happens the way it once did, but I just think if you're just a musician that can be a musician for hire, and maybe you're creative also, it just seems like the paradigm is you do your own thing now, and you call who you want to have on it, or it's like, it's with your homies. Like, it's like, you know, I know this is probably like old hat to most people, but like the Snarky Puppy thing, which was just, you know, they did the tried and true, get in the van, play everywhere, say yes to just about everything, you know, besides being a great band. Like, that's the part everyone thinks.
They were also a really big band, which we all know is impossible to pay everyone well, you know, when you're starting out. So, I mean, that is like an anomaly. Like, the fact that they made it, it's like inspiring.
I don't know. And it's hard to talk about it because who knows if that paradigm will be rescued from what I'm afraid will happen in wake of things being kind of on hold, you know, because I don't know that this is to be true, but it seems like for a lot of people that are independent that don't work with the bigger promoters, if the bigger promoters are the ones that are giving these clubs the lifeline, what's going to happen to the little guy?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I worry about.
Yeah. They'll just take everything.
Right. Like, is everyone going to have to bow to the altar of like Live Nation, whether they like it or not? Like, just to play like the small places, you know, like, is it Live Nation presents like Michael Landau,
the 55 bar?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know,
it's
man.
It's like that awful saying of when there's, you know, when there's blood in the streets, you fucking buy everything. And that's like,
I mean, what these, I'm definitely hoping. Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping for the best. You know, I think that, you know, Jake and I have talking about how the system or the relationship between musicians and club owners was already broken. So this is maybe giving us a time to heal that, or at least understand each other, because, you know, both of us are in trouble now. The club owner is in grave trouble if they're still open. And the musicians need to understand that it's going to be a slow process to rebuild this. It's not just going to be like, all right, COVID's gone. Like, here, you're still going to get $250 for this gig or whatever it is. You know, it's going to take a minute, man. And it's going to be weird. And it's important to do your own thing and come up with multiple income streams if possible, of course, because that's always a, you know, nothing else was learned from this, that would be, you know.
There's nothing wrong with people being a little more proactive about mining the store. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I definitely don't want to never tour the world again. Like, I definitely, even if I was sort of maybe in a place of like, well, I don't know if I want to do this forever, I hope that chance comes back, and I'm looking forward to the day that it does. But I'm also, I'm not going to like lie and say that I think one thing I'm grateful for, and this is going to sound weird, I didn't have some kind of amazing tour on the books for 2020. I think that would have been really heartbreaking. I'm kind of glad that I was sort of at a place where it's like, well, I feel good about music again, and I feel good about the possibilities. You know, even like the last gig I did before it all ended was a great one, you know? Yeah. Nightmare scenario for COVID, though, because it was like no stage, surrounded by people.
Right.
I was playing with like Mark Letary at this it was like a hotel club down in downtown LA, but it was a great band. We had a good time. All the homies came out, but it was also like surrounded by people. And I would say this was like where I was washing my hands in between sets, but meanwhile, not realizing that like there's faces right in front of me, like breathing out.
I have faith. I mean, we're getting close to, you know, to the end of this, and it's been awesome to rap with you, man, because like I said, I know that obviously you're a great musician, but you're also an intelligent cat and you're always thinking, and you know, I love that stuff. But you know, I do have faith, and it's not just me trying to do that to be positive on a podcast, but I do have faith that art will come of this, and that there will be a way and a rebirth of some kind, a renaissance, but it's going to take a minute, and people can't expect the same thing. And to be honest, like we said, the system was kind of broken. The club owners were mad at the musicians were mad at the club owners. Like, you know, people were getting more into house concerts and trying to do their own thing. So, you know, it's up to us to make people want to listen again and make people want to come to the seats and to make creative music that's not the same thing. So I think that it's important for us to, you know, be ourselves and to be better. And, you know, because ultimately we have to get a fan base. And if we can do that, we can control everything. If people want to see you, you could do it at your house. You don't need a club, you know? So,
yeah, I think that kind of freedom is what interests me more than bragging rights, because, you know, you're on like Jimmy Kimmel with some band that you're touring. I don't know. Not that that's bad, but you know what I'm saying?
Like, I'm with you. Yeah. That's just like, yeah, that is a status symbol almost. That is something that can be seen, and that, you know, endorsers love, of course, you know what I mean? They love that and big social media numbers, but that's not, you know, that's not like true enlightenment or happiness. You know, you don't know what's going on behind the scenes with any of that stuff. So you just got to do you and do it the best you can.
Yeah. I mean, there's a trite way of putting it where it's like, I think just having the ability to say no, but I don't know if that explains the actual sentiment. I think what wears on me, and it probably wears on a lot of people, is that little voice that tells you, oh, you should be doing this because this is what you're supposed to be doing. Like, if the minute that stuff comes in there is when I think a lot of stuff gets corrupted. Because sometimes that stuff pulls you off the course that you should be on, which is like staying true to yourself. And it doesn't mean that like there aren't things to consider, because there are a lot of things to consider with music, you know, but I do think sometimes that stuff, I know whenever I've been my most unfocused, it's been when those types of thoughts have consumed the way I assess my decision making and professional, you know, goals and stuff, you know. And I always feel like it's the most disingenuous place to be sometimes.
I mean, ultimately, like if you're a musician, there are very few of us who are making millions of dollars doing this. So if you're compromising your vision, you know, it better be for a good reason, right? I mean, and you know, and sometimes it is. Sometimes you get a gig that's paying so well that it might not be your favorite thing, and you're going to put off your solo project and this other stuff. But it, you know what? If you can buy a house from it, do it, you know? By all means. But if it's not that, you know, you have to do some soul searching. I think that that's a really, really cool way to leave this off, man. And like, dude, thanks so much for being on this. I haven't seen you in forever. We texted back and forth like randomly. Few and far between. But man, it's great. And like, you know, you have a great perspective, and I'm glad you can make it out and do this, or make it into that room wherever you are. You didn't have to make it out, right? We're all virtual.
Right. Thanks for having me, man. This is fun.
Right on, brother. And you know, hopefully we see each other soon, man.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, man.
Absolutely.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail? You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes, so we look forward to hearing from you.